In the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being here. We've got great things to talk about today. And as you know, well, you may not know, that we are, in fact, looking at the beatification of Father Michael McGivney, the founder of the Knights of Columbus. It's going to take place tomorrow morning. I believe it's 10 a.m. At the Diocese of Hartford, Connecticut. And Father McGivney from New Haven, my hometown, and Knights of Columbus, of course, were birthed there. We're going to talk with Doug Keck today from EWTN, as well as Maureen Walther, who has written a great history of the Knights of Columbus. We're going to talk about Father McGivney and get a feel for who he was. And then, of course, Doug will prepare us for tomorrow's beatification ceremony, covered, of course, on EWTN. Dr. Scott Hahn will be joining me today talking about growing in your vocation when you go on vacation. We're going to talk about the Good News Cruise for Couples that's coming up in January of 2022, and Scott will be a part of that event with myself and Teresa and many others. We're also going to take time to sit down with Dr. Paul Kengor, who wants to remind us of something. Joe Biden had an important role in cementing Roe v. Wade as the law of the land. Going back to the Supreme Court nominee David Souter from New Hampshire, we're going to talk about how Souter got on the court and his role in basically cementing Roe v. Wade by his decision in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. We've got much more we're going to talk about as well. We've got tensions rising between Islamic communities in France. We're going to talk to Raymond Ibrahim about that. And I have a few words to say, too, about the upcoming election. But first, it's the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, October 30th. It's the Feast of St. Narcissus of Jerusalem. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. French bishops ordering a death knell to ring from every church in the country after three Catholics were murdered in the Basilica of Notre Dame in Nice, France yesterday. Thursday morning, an Islamic extremist nearly beheading an elderly woman and stabbing a sacristan and another woman in the basilica. He was arrested after the attack. French police are treating the killings as a terrorist incident. The death toll from Hurricane Zeta is now up to six, and four of those lives were lost from trees falling on their homes.
The storm crashed ashore in Louisiana, leaving a trail of damage in seven states. Zeta was the 27th storm of the Atlantic hurricane season. It's now weakened to a post-tropical storm. Dean Muccio, NBC News Radio.
Sky News in the United Kingdom is reporting that the country has breached the worst-case scenario for coronavirus infections and hospital admissions. The UK government scientific advisory group for emergencies said the new infections are doubling every 15 days. The last time Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave an update from Downing Street on the coronavirus, over a week ago. NASA astronaut Kate Rubin's the only American not on the planet right now to cast her vote for president from space. She said the process is similar to that of military service members overseas, except that she quipped she doesn't believe she counts as overseas. About 2 pounds of rock and soil collected from an asteroid is ready to head back to Earth. NASA officials saying Thursday a sample from the asteroid Bennu was successfully sealed in a protective reentry capsule, which will return to Earth in 2023. The soil was collected from the 1,600-foot-long asteroid that is orbiting the sun, which has been classified as a near-Earth object. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I want to discuss a little bit about this election season and compare it to the past a little bit. You know, accusations of white nationalism, a breakaway primary candidate who's a blatant socialist, impeachment headlines, a president who's had bitter public feuds with his own Congress, resurgence of populism, a game-changing new form of media, a president who aims fake news accusations at the national press, terrorism in the Middle East, a once booming economy with historically low unemployment in danger, the FBI on the trail of a major presidential candidate regarding a possible Russian conspiracy, a president stumping hard in the closing days of the campaign from city to city. The challenger, confident that he can win by laying low, not focusing on issues, but smiling a lot and looking approachable. That year was 1948, the first post-war presidential election. It was Dewey versus Truman. And indeed, all of these things were present in that campaign. I could not believe my eyes when I began to go over that list. I should give credit to A.J. Baim in his book Dewey Defeats Truman, the 1948 election and the battle for America's soul, for pointing out the similarities between the 48 year and this year of 2020. Back in the 48, it was the first election to play out on the television machine, right? It was the new form of media. And in fact, 1948 was the most shocking electoral upset in the history of the United States up to that point. And some people think up until 2016. And in the years after 1948, it was commonly said that all Americans could remember exactly where they were on two occasions: when they heard the news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, and when they heard the result of the 1948 presidential election. Truman's campaign was called at that time the most colorful and astonishing political campaign in modern American history, a gigantic comedy, the wildest campaign of the century. I bring this up not because I think there's any divine connection here, but I like to point out that oftentimes the things that we think are new to our generation are not. I'll go over the list again just because I think it's so stunning. A groundswell of accusations regarding white nationalism, a breakaway primary campaign candidate who's an outspoken socialist, impeachment headlines, a president often caught in bitter public feud with his own Congress, a resurgence of populism across the land, a game-changing new form of media, a chief executive aiming fake news accusations at the national press, terrorism in the Middle East, once booming economy with historically low unemployment, the FBI on the trail of a major presidential candidate regarding a possible Russian conspiracy, a president stumping hard from city to city, the challenger kind of laid back, confident he can win by just not getting in the way of his opponent's unpopularity. Again, the year was 1948, and it led to a stunning surprise. Remember the headline, the Chicago Daily Tribune headline? It's often seen in history documentaries, Dewey Defeats Truman. Of course, it turned out just the other way around. There's this wonderful classic picture of Harry Truman holding up the Chicago Daily Tribune headline and smiling, and you can understand why. We don't know. You know, the future. And so it's important for us to do what we can do when we can do it, and then leave the results to God. But it is important for us to do what we can. And it's become more difficult to talk. about political issues with our friends. I remember the first great political question. I've brought this up many times. It's attributed to Aristotle. The first great political question is, how ought we to order our lives together? Now, this assumes that we know who the we is, so we know who's in the circle of discussion, but it also assumes that we don't already agree. How ought we to order our lives together? And to answer the question, you have to figure out ways to make decisions as a we, as a body, political body. Now, I'm not going to take time to go into civic lessons about elections, campaigns, crafting of bills, legislation. I want to go to something much more fundamental and which is much more closer to a Catholic contribution to culture. How ought we to order our lives together? The first thing, of course, is to listen to one another. And especially for Christians who are told to love one another. We can at least listen to one another, even if we can't get up to loving one another. I mean, loving and listening are not the door to compromising. Jesus loved, he listened. St. Paul loved, he listened. They didn't compromise. And I do think that today, though, we've got people who actually feel as though they cannot associate. They cannot associate with those with whom they disagree politically. There's an old Calvin and Hobbes strip going back to November 1993. And you've got Calvin brooding a little bit, and he says to Hobbes, "Help me think of an issue to debate for this dumb paper," his school paper. And Hobbes says, "Well, what issues do you care about?" Calvin, "I don't care about issues. I got better things to do than argue with every wrong-headed crackpot with an ignorant opinion. I'm a busy man. I say either agree with me or take a hike. I'm right, period. End of discussion." Hobbes looks at him and says, right. And Calvin says, "Yeah, see, everybody's happy now." We heard something like this the other night with Don Lemon on CNN, where he let us all know that there are people, friends of his, that he can no longer abide because of their political position. Listen carefully to what he said here.
"And I had to get rid of a lot of people in my life because sometimes you just have to let them go. I think that they have to hit rock bottom like an addict. Right? And they have to want to get help. They have to want to know the truth. They have to want to live in reality. They have to want to be responsible, not only for other people's lives, but for their lives. So you know what? It's so sad. And I don't know if after this I will ever be able to go back and be friends with those people, because at a certain point you just say they're too far gone and I got to let them go. And if they're willing to come back and if they're willing to live in reality, then I will welcome them with open arms. But I can't do it. I can't do it anymore."
Think about that. Here's a guy who's so incapable of making room in his life for those with whom he disagrees. Basically, if you disagree with me, you're on the level with an addict, and you're going to have to hit bottom. And then, I don't know, maybe if they repent and come groveling back to me, I might be able to accept them. That's the kind of world we're living in right now. And remember, this is not just some guy sitting on a bar stool. This is a guy who occupies one of the respected cable channels in America, has an evening program. And yet he's so immature that he cannot make room in his mind and heart for friends of his who disagree with him. And the reason that happens is because you're not listening. People, again, if people will communicate why they believe what they believe, you don't necessarily agree with them. But what you do is you at least understand how that human, made in God's image, who has the capacity of reason and choice, at least you can understand how he got to those opinions. You may not respect the opinions, I get that, but you have to respect the person. And I do think it's Christians who are citizens of the United States who are in the best position to keep reminding one another that how we ought to order our lives together is an essential component of a free society. We must ask ourselves, how are we going to do this thing? And we can't do it if all of a sudden our people who are feeding us our information, you know, through national and international news networks, can't possibly even listen to their friends with whom they disagree. How do you think he handles news? You know? Okay, we've got a little bit of time left. I do want to continue to go through forming consciences for faithful citizenship. We were up to about 86 there, where we were talking about care for our common home, and the bishops of the United States say that our conference offers a distinctive call to seriously address global climate change, focusing on the virtue of prudence, pursuit of the common good, and the impact on the poor, particularly on vulnerable workers and the poorest nations. The United States should lead in contributing to the sustainable development of poorer nations and promoting greater justice in sharing the burden of environmental blight, neglect, and recovery. It is important that we address the rising number of migrants who are uprooted from their homeland as a consequence of environmental degradation and climate change. They are not currently recognized as refugees in any existing international convention and are thus not accorded legal protections that ought to be due to them. There's a long section here on our nation's efforts to reduce poverty, and these should not be associated with demeaning and sometimes coercive population control programs. What follows is a long quote from Pope Francis in Laudato Si. Instead of resolving the problems of the poor and thinking of how the world can be different, some can only propose a reduction in the birth rate. At times, developing countries face forms of international pressure, which make economic assistance contingent on certain policies of, quote, reproductive health. Yet, while it is true that an unequal distribution of the population and of available resources creates obstacles to development and a sustainable use of the environment, it must nonetheless be recognized that demographic growth is fully compatible with an integral and shared development. To blame population growth instead of an extreme and selective consumerism on the part of some is one way of refusing to face the issues. It is an attempt to legitimize the present model of distribution where a minority believes that it has the right to consume in a way which can never be universalized, since the planet could not even contain the waste products of such consumption. Again, as we've seen, and Pope Francis has acknowledged, many of these are prudential judgments in terms of what the planet can hold. But the one thing that's not a prudential judgment is that we have care for one another.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Not everyone who's attracted to the Lord and to a life of service is necessarily meant to be a priest. So there's all kinds of forms. I mean, from, let's say, the Brotherhood, if you want to stay within a formal religious context, but then all kinds of ministries within a parish, all kinds of lay ministries that you can do. So not everyone's called to the priesthood. A priest is someone who is dedicated, devoted to ongoing study and ongoing prayer, to be a spiritual father. As Pope Benedict said, one of his wisest remarks, he said, people want many things from a priest, but what they want above all is someone who's a master of the spiritual life. Hey, I'm great at this ministry, and hey, I'm great at organizing this meeting, and hey, I'm great. Fine, but ultimately what the people want is you're a master of the spiritual life. You got to be, therefore, trained in prayer and theology and spirituality and so on.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What is truth? Pontius Pilate asked Jesus, not realizing that he was looking at truth. Jesus Christ is the truth and the source of all truth. The Catholic Catechism states that man tends by nature toward the truth and that he is obliged to honor and bear witness to it. Thomas Aquinas asserts men could not live together if there were not mutual confidence that they were being truthful with one another. Truth entails both honesty and discretion between what ought to be expressed and what ought to be kept secret. Jesus told Pilate that he had come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Thus, the Catechism states, in situations that require witness to the truth of Jesus, a Christian must profess it without equivocation, even at the sacrifice of his own life. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
I turned from a recreational drug user to a drug addict. That took me to my knees. I lost a family, almost two families. I lost friends. Now that I'm back in the Catholic Church, I'm a new person. I love it. I love it. My heart's there. I took communion after 18 years, and the rest of the Mass I sat and cried. God restored my life. God restored my family. God restored my love.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, and with me is Doug Keck, President and Chief Operating Officer at EWTN. Doug, good to have you again. Thanks.
Great to be with you, Al. Always great to be on your show. Thanks for asking.
I see we've got the beatification ceremony for Father Michael McGivney coming up tomorrow on EWTN, and in thinking about this, a lot of people don't realize that he was active at a very difficult time in American political history. This was the rise of the Klan, and Father McGivney really fought hard to ensure that Catholics would have free expression and religious liberty. Within the framework he was able to work in. He died at age 38, so, I mean, he didn't have a lot of time. But this election coming up is one in which we've talked a lot about the life issue, but this is also going to be a critical election for the religious liberty issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, we're carrying a lot of programming for the beatification. We've got the vigil that's happening tonight as well. And then the Mass, and there's actually some other specials. People can check out EWTN.com for all the different programming we've got related to that, as well as for All Saints and All Souls Day coming up as well. But, yeah, I think that's part of what gets lost there, I think, in the discussion, is that for people to realize that you're talking about a candidate who's talking about reinstating certain things that do impair our religious liberty. And yeah. And a lot of what you've seen going on, obviously, in your state and other states with these kind of mandatory lockdowns where mm-hmm. somehow, you know, liquor stores are essential, but church isn't. And, I don't know that they do a lot of social distancing in bars and liquor stores, but apparently they do a better job than people who go to church. I don't know quite how that works out, but that seems to be the idea. And it's kind of sad because it seems like a lot of us have allowed ourselves to be cornered on our faith and cowed by the cancel culture, the PC culture out there. you know, and, you know, instead of standing up. And I think many of us, and I'm hoping that maybe when you're alone and you're voting on your own, people speak their mind more. I think a lot of us, you know, have in other ways have allowed ourselves to be, remain silent when things are happening, and instead of standing up. And I think now's the time for us to stand up in how we vote. I mean, a lot of us don't have the eloquence to go and stand up, or maybe the wherewithal, the courage to stand up as a Mother Angelica would, or you do, Al, or others do, or even just your friends who happen to be the more outspoken ones. Mm-hmm. But here's an opportunity to stand up. And I think one of the great lies we have in our mind is it couldn't happen here. And I think one of the great insights we get from a lot of recent even immigration immigrants is, you know, people who came from Venezuela, people right. who've come from Cuba, people who have come from behind the Iron Curtain countries, you know, even people who have come from China and Vietnam and other places have said, you know, we've been there, done that. It doesn't work. You don't understand. It all starts this way. Slowly you lose your rights. It doesn't happen all the time, right. all at once. And you got to be very, very careful. It's a very alluring thing. It's like the devil. There's a lot of temptation. This is great. We can get all this stuff, and it doesn't cost me anything. Well, just your soul. But you yeah. don't realize that right away.
Yeah, right. Well, I do think that this election coming up is going to be calling us all to a deep and sustained prayer. And I do love the idea that we got the beatification of Father McGivney the weekend prior to this election. That's especially... I'd like to think it's a providential intention there, because
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely. It's considering, as we all know and we've all said, that one of the charges against somebody for being serving in the country's highest courts these days is that you know, the Knights of Columbus or some sort of
that's right,
yeah. you know, anti-gay, anti, you know, freedom of expression organization, like a cult. Right. You know, kind of a thing. And people need to realize that when they're saying that about you, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, somebody pointed out recently, I hadn't really thought of it this way, then when somebody's saying effectively that, well, you know, Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler, well, what are they saying about you if you support
right.
Donald Trump? They're
right.
saying you're some sort of Hitlerite or some sort of Nazi?
I know.
Come on.
I know.
As somebody would say.
Yeah. I can remember when George W. Bush was in the presidency, they said he was a Hitler. And I don't think people have much of an understanding of how different the political circumstances were that gave rise to a Hitler or a Mussolini. The United States is not in that position.
Right.
We like to talk about our president as the most powerful man on earth, but the truth of the matter is he's actually quite limited. He's got a huge federal bureaucratic apparatus there that he's got to deal with unions. He's got to deal with previous policies. He's got a cabinet that he appoints, but which still, you know, he can't just ride roughshod, or rarely can they ride roughshod over.
Right.
He's got Congress. He's got a judiciary. So when I hear people say they see President Trump and they see him, because he's an authoritative guy, presents himself as larger than life, well, he's going to be a dictator. He's not going to be. He can't be. It's not going
right.
to. It can't happen here. It's just possible.
The thing is, as you guys have pointed out many times on the air and on our other shows, is the idea you always have to remember the Nazis were socialists.
Yeah, and that's right.
And Mussolini, who started the fascists, came out of socialism.
Right.
He was a socialist as well.
That is right.
And the people who killed everybody in China are socialists. And the people who killed everybody in Vietnam are socialists or socialist communists. And the same thing with, you know, what happened in the Soviet Union, the mm-hmm. Eastern Bloc, and what happened in Cambodia.
Yeah.
So for all these people who are worried about totalitarian things, there are situations on both sides, but quite honestly, the one that's done the most havoc, and again, these two things, you know, communism and fascism, they meet in the same place.
They do.
They have different ways of describing why they're doing what they're doing, but ultimately their tactics are exactly the same, which is ultimately you only have the freedom we allow you as long as you go along with what we want done.
That's right. That's right. They get to define what... They get to define who you are. You are defined by your proper participation in their project, their agenda.
Right.
You exist for them. The state.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It sounds good. Let's all work for the betterment of all. But ultimately, what happens is an elite group decides that you have to give up your freedom and your individualism for the good of the whole, which is another way of saying for the good of them who are running the whole.
Right, right. Yeah, that's, again, goes George Orwell's Animal Farm. What's it, something
absolutely.
Like all animals are equal, but some
all
animals
pigs,
are more equal than
all
others.
Pigs are equal,
all pigs
some
are equal.
Pigs are more equal than others, right.
Right, right.
Absolutely, because that's just the way it is. Isn't that what God said? I mean, we're dealing with pride. We want to be like God. Everybody wants to be better. Everybody's going to decide that there's somebody lesser than them so that they can feel good about themselves.
Right.
That's the original sin that we're dealing with.
That's right.
Unfortunately, these people who push this stuff don't believe that. They think that structures in society make people feel, and if you just start treating everybody and teach everybody better, they're going to naturally do the right thing. It's not true. The great Father Benedict Rochelle said, you know, The idea that we should become all the human we are is the scariest thing we ever heard. He said, the last thing I need to be is who I really am. What I need to be is who God can make me into.
Amen.
You know, that's what it is. It's that transcendent aspect that it makes me a decent person in this life. This idea that somehow I'm really perfectly born and I'm malformed by society, is they've got it backwards.
Right, right. Yeah, that's especially powerful coming from the late Father Groeschel, because
right.
he got his earned doctorate in that field of psychology during the era when that's exactly what people were saying. You've got to become your own truest self, but with no reference to God. So,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And as defined by you, and we're seeing that more and more, as you say, even in the Twitter world, the Facebook world, this idea of, well, your community standards, wait a second, is set by who?
Right.
You know, they all complained over the years, all the liberals, all who say, well, you can't have these constraints to free speech and people need to be who they are until they get in charge.
Yeah.
Then suddenly the rules change.
Right.
And everybody is, you know, when you're not in charge, you want freedom. All of a sudden, when you're in charge, it's amazing how dictatorial people get right away with their own perspectives. It's like that story you had about Don Lemon.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly people disagree with him and he has to cross them off and block them. Why? I mean, red pill, blue pill. We have to decide
right.
what we're going to do. You know, we live in a world now where we don't want to hear anybody else's opinion. And the Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, very popular documentary we did on Saul Alinsky, is all about this idea that we can't have a disagreement and actually agree to disagree and stay
right.
friends. We have to demonize the other person.
Right.
And what we've seen, even if you believe what's going on with the Hunter Biden thing, is everything that they've accused Trump of is what they were doing.
Yes, 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 that's true. Because they've accused the president of continually feathering his own nest.
Classic Alinsky tactics.
Yeah.
Project your problems onto the other.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
And demonize them. They don't have different beliefs. They're evil people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting because Christians themselves are in the position of wanting to stay in touch with those with whom they disagree. That's kind of a mandate for us. Otherwise, we have no people to communicate the gospel to.
Absolutely.
So,
and that's the idea. But the idea, and I think the Pope has got it right when he says, you know, encounter and accompany. I think where it falls short is the accompaniment. The accompaniment isn't going along the road that person's
right.
get on his bad road and stay with him. It's
right.
how do I bring this person gently to the truth, as a good parent does who loves their children. You know, I understand, you know, you love your son Joe Biden, you know, Biden loves his son Hunter. I understand that. That's perfectly true. He will always love him. It doesn't mean he should encourage him involved in the things that are going wrong in his life, and hopefully
right.
he hasn't
right.
done that. And you need to be able to call that out. But you can't act like it's not there, and you can't support somebody who's doing something wrong. And all of us, just because we might have made mistakes in the past, we should be telling people, you know, I made a mistake,
right.
you need to not make that mistake. Isn't that what the whole culture of therapeutics is all about.
Yes, yes, that's right. And we're supposed to be transparent in that respect, and that gives hope, can give hope to others. I want to make sure, because we're running out of time, tomorrow we've got EWTN's coverage of the beatification. That begins at 10, is it?
Yes.
10 o'clock, EWTN. Okay. And can people, where can they get more information on the All Saints Day coverage?
Oh, go to EWTN.com and just check out our programming for TV and radio. It's all there. All the information's there. Also, our voter's guide there. And also, if you haven't seen the Wolf in Sheep's Clothing on the first one on Alinsky, you can watch it for free on our on-demand platform.
Very good. Doug, thanks. We'll talk again.
Thanks, Al.
Religious freedom and health care and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
How does the baby move in your tummy?
How does the baby eat?
Can the baby hear me?
How did the baby get in there?
Wow, a pregnancy can sure generate a lot of questions. But what's important is that a baby is a baby, inside and out of the womb. Not just after birth, but 9 months before, at conception.
That's right. Every baby is a miracle. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of alternatives or assistance, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org, or better yet, simply dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword pro-life. Pro-Life Across America is non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Pro-life across America, the billboard people.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
He recently filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and the Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Health, challenging, among other things, the state's Orwellian contact tracing program. Under this program, Big Brother is alive and well in Pennsylvania. Indeed, the contact tracing program grants the government extraordinary power to impose draconian restrictions, including a 14-day quarantine, which is the equivalent of a house arrest. The restrictions are enforced through fines and criminal penalties, and there is no procedure for challenging the government's orders. If you or someone who may have had contact with you tests positive for COVID-19, an army of contact tracers will hunt you down. Through this program, the government uses its authority to inquire into and search out the private associations of individuals and their children, tracing where they have been and who they were with. The breadth of government power under this program forces individuals to keep their children from attending public schools in person, to avoid seeking medical treatment, and to avoid businesses, restaurants, and other public or social events that may keep rosters, lists, video, or other ways to document persons who entered the business establishment or attended the event. The program also forces individuals to avoid worship services where pre-registration is required. The power grab by liberal politicians during this current pandemic is devastating to freedom. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute.
Started drinking beer on Saturday nights, sleeping in on Sunday mornings, missing Mass, and then it just became a pattern and continued. Without God, I don't know where I'd be right now. I know the importance of the Eucharist. I know the importance of the sacraments that I didn't know at a young age. I follow God's will because my desire is to get to heaven. Our lives are rich and full by being members of the church.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You know, it's been a while since I talked to you about something we began really earlier this year. It was the Good News Cruise that we had in January. It was spectacular. And we did it, you know, in conjunction with corporate travel. And so many of our friends, Deacon Harold Brooks Sivers was there. We had Father John Ricardo, Salem, myself were there, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Teresa, of course, and Dominic were with us. It was spectacular. And then we came home, and it was COVID. And so we weren't able to do anything with it. In fact, we were hoping to have one coming up next January, you know, 2021. But, you know, you can't plan in this environment very easily. So what we've done, and this is, I really want to make this clear. We have a 2022 Good News Cruise for Couples coming up. That's 2022. And I just learned today as we were preparing the program that we are able to actually encourage you to respond to this Good News Cruise by going to goodnewscruise.com. And in fact, if you book now, you get $50 off per person. You have to use the code All Saints, though, because it's All Saints weekend, right? So I want to stress, this is, those of you who were with us last year know exactly how remarkable it was. It was better than I anticipated. And we're going to have a tremendous time. I wish we were able to do it this coming January. It's going to be January 2022. But if you go to goodnewscruise.com right now and, again, register, you'll get $50 off per person. Just make sure you're using the code All Saints. And one of our speakers who's going to be joining us for this cruise is Dr. Scott Hahn. He's authored most recently of Hope to Die, The Christian Meaning of Death and the Resurrection of the Body. Scott's been incredibly prolific, over 40 books, and he is the Father Michael Scanlon Professor of Biblical Theology and the New Evangelization at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, where he's taught since 1990. He's founder and president of the St. Paul Center, an apostolate which teaches Catholics to read Scripture within the heart of the Church. Scott has been married to Kimberly for 40 years. They have 6 children, 18 grandchildren, 2 of their sons. In priestly formation now for the Diocese of Steubenville. Hey, Scott, how are you?
Brother Al, it's great to hear your voice. Likewise. I should revise. We just had number 19 grandchild earlier this month, and 41 years.
It's 41 years now.
Celebrated.
Good for you.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's so good to hear your voice. I'm looking forward to with you and Sally. This is going to be a wonderful time, even if we have to postpone it a year.
Yeah, yeah. I know we were hoping it would be this coming January, but it's January 2022. And I was just telling listeners that we've got this offer valid, you know, it's $50 off per person. If they go to goodnewscruise.com, they can register, make sure they use the code All Saints. But this is the first time we've actually got a chance to mention it on this program. So I'm glad you're with me to do that. Marriage is such, you know, it's a sacrament. We know that, but it's in one way, it's more than a sacrament. I mean, it's at the heart of God's dealing with His creation, with Christ's dealing with His church, and in our human experience, of course, we have the covenant of marriage. But that covenant can be expanded to include, of course, Christ and the church and God and the world. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, let me just speak to this Good News Cruise because, to be honest, it's like the best of both worlds. I've been with Kimberly on various marriage conferences, retreats, workshops, and those have always been tremendously helpful to us, but also to other couples, to those that are strong and to those that are struggling. We've also been on a number of cruises in the last 25 years, and those are also amazing and memorable. And so blessed, but to combine the two, it's like the best of both worlds. Yeah. And so I just want to underscore what you were saying about, even though it's a long way off, nevertheless, there is a special discount, but also it's something to kind of look forward to. as we crawl out of the year 2020 and get through 2021 and look back on whatever the outcome of the election is and the cultural convulsions, it'll just be an ideal way to celebrate the post-Christmas time as couples. And so I am grateful and I'm excited. And so I think if people hear this opportunity, I really do believe that they'll take advantage of it and really end up being mightily blessed. But to your question, you know, secondly, I think we forget that, you know, marriage goes back to the beginning, and we didn't decide to get married with God's permission in Genesis 2. Man, male and female found themselves in a relationship the way he made us.
Right.
And so to recognize that marriage is not only a divine institution, but it is unique and it is powerful. Even in the strictly natural order, we have this covenant tie with one another as husband and a wife, and also a vertical bond with God. Let no one put asunder what God has joined together. And God joined them together in a covenant way back in the beginning of the Old Testament, as you indicated. But Jesus then elevates that to one of the seven sacraments in the new covenant. So not only does marriage end up surviving the flood, if you ever go to a matrimonial mass, you will hear in one of the prayers that this is the one institution that ended up emerging from the waters of the flood.
Right.
And so the culture, the social order, everything that was there collapsed, and yet marriage and family life are the things that God not only spared, but really sanctified. And if that was true in the old, it's immeasurably more in the new. A sacrament, you know, what is that? Well, it's something that Christ himself administers, but not in splendid isolation, precisely through this relationship of communion with his bride, the church. You know, that is not a metaphor. That is a mystery, but it's more real than the marriage between Scott and Kimberly, which has been going on for 41 years. But, you know, in the end, we're going to be not married or given in marriage, as our Lord said, and yet we're going to be entering into what the New Testament describes as the marriage supper of the Lamb.
Right.
So all of the intimacy, all of the ecstasy, all of the joy that we've had in these 41 years is going to be magnified so much. We'll look back and realize that the happiest marriages on earth were almost miserable in comparison to the joy that will go by in a million years. And that might sound like spicy, hot religious rhetoric or sort of holy hyperbole, but rest assured, when we get there and look back on this interview, we'll all agree Scott's words fell flat on their faces. They fall short of that joy that awaits us because we believe in God the Father Almighty. He's got something in store for us that goes beyond our wildest dreams.
It's in this time in our nation's history, in our culture's history, the choice to marry and to raise children is one of the most radical choices you can make as a Christian. I mean, you are, by marrying, you are bearing witness to a divine institution. And you need training. You need to enter more deeply into it. When I was a kid growing up, I had no idea that you were supposed to learn how to be a husband, how to be a father. I always assumed that just came, you know, with being human. Once I was married and a father, I realized how much time I had to spend thinking intentionally about what kind of father I'm going to be, what kind of husband I'm going to be. And, of course, the Good News Cruise gives us a chance to really think about our marriages as forms of witness to this world, which is losing its grasp on marriage.
Right.
So
you're right. You know, we had a conversation just a little more than a year ago. I think it was in D.C. And one of the topics that we discussed was marriage. You know, I had come out with a book that's almost 2 years old now called The First Society, the Sacrament of Matrimony, and the Restoration of the Social Order. You used the R word a minute ago, radical. That's exactly what it is. You'd almost want to say revolutionary, except given the summer and all of the riots, I would propose counter-revolutionary is a much better word choice, you know.
Right.
But if we want to counter the violence and the convulsions and the relativism of our age, we have to recognize why Jesus made this a sacrament in the new covenant and not merely the covenant it was back in creation, because we need an infusion of divine grace from heaven through Christ in the church like never before. And the sacrament of matrimony doesn't make it easy. Right. It just makes it possible.
Right.
And, you know, in 41 years, I can look back and honestly say I never knew a married couple that had as much fun and friendship as Kimberly and I have. And yet I can also say that I have never had a relationship in my life where there has been more frustration
right.
than I've gotten from her, and she's gotten far more frustration from me. How does it work? You know, how can it be so fun and fulfilling and yet more frustrating than any other relationship? Well, you know, you have love for your parents, you have love for your neighbors, you have love for your coworkers, your, you know, all kinds of people, your siblings too. But there is only one love that God designed to be expressed in such a way as to create a new person out of nothing.
I mean,
but
yes.
that marital intimacy, that yeah. covenant love, the two become one flesh, and the one flesh we become is more than what happened on our honeymoon night. That one flesh ends up getting a name, Michael, yeah. and then Gabriel, Hannah, Jeremiah, Joseph, and David. Our six kids are the incarnation of the oneness of our life, our love. And again, this is why it's not just rhetoric. It's something more than ritual. This sacrament is pointing to something that is so much more real than the things that we see or feel tonight, tomorrow, and the next day. And so if we don't trust God and love him above all things, you know, at that point, marriage is not just hard, it's humanly impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I say this about the Eucharist. It doesn't surprise me that 70% of Americans say they don't believe. What amazes me is that 30% of us do. And if God can get through to us, he can probably get through to the others, and he might want to use us. But the same thing is true about marriage. As a covenant, not just a contract, as a sacrament, and not just a symbol. If it's all of that, then only then can we enter into something much bigger than ourselves and get a power that comes from a source that is infinitely stronger than I am or she is. And you know, it was a sacrament for us 41 years ago when we were still Protestants. We just didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in discovering it and getting our marriage blessed, we entered into this mystery in a sense that it was more intentional, it was more conscious, it was also more humbling, because by then we realized, whoa,
yeah.
I am glad it's not just a sacrament that's up to us to keep.
Right.
It's a sacrament. You know, I'm glad it's not just a covenant that we have to keep on our own, but a sacrament that Jesus uses to kind of inject that medicine of mercy that we need all the time. I mean, I just went to confession this week, and I've gone weekly since we got married and I became Catholic. And I mean, she's never suggested that I go too much because, you know, I need to apologize
sure.
and I need to be forgiven. And sometimes she does too. And so, you know, I don't mean to drown you in verbiage, but boy, I tell you, this is, you know, the Good News Cruise picks up that term because Pope Benedict said this several years ago, that the sacrament of marriage is the gospel in itself. It's the good news of life-giving love.
Amen. Scott, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll talk and see one another before January of 2022, but I'm looking forward to January of 2022.
Yeah.
So we'll see you then. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Dr. Scott Hahn, goodnewscruise.com. We'll be together. Sign up.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's the definition of frustration? Frustration is the difference between the way it is and the way you want it to be. It's hard to change the way it is. The way it is sometimes is other people, life, circumstances. The way you want it to be is in your power to change. You can close the gap between reality and what you want. The smaller that gap, the less your frustration. It is always easier to change oneself than to change reality. Frustration isn't always what happens out there. It is how we look at what happens out there.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You know, I'm looking here at some, well, interesting, a strange article just came across my desk, dealing with marriage, by the way. Not going to go into it right now, but I do want to call our attention back to this January 2022 Good News Cruise for Couples. You heard Scott last segment talking about it. And I'm looking over the list. This is the first time I've announced it, so I want to, that's why I'm dancing a little bit with it. I've looked over our guests, our presenters, and I realize every one of them is a friend. It's just one of those funny things. Teresa Tamayo and her husband Deacon Dom going to be there. Alan Sears from the Alliance Defense Fund. Father John Ricardo. Father Leo Patlinghug. Father Joe Krupp. Scott and Kimberly. Dr. Ray Guarendi. Archbishop Charles Chaput, who I haven't seen in a while, but has been very encouraging over the years, this ministry, and Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, who I just talked with a few weeks ago. And that's what I remember from January of this year, and that is all of us who were presenters had some lots of interaction over the years together in ministry, and it makes for a beautiful family-like environment there, even among the presenters. So go to goodnewscruise.com, register, $50 off per person. Use the code All Saints, okay? All Saints, that's
this
the code.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
In the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I'm glad to be here. We've got another hour in front of us, and we're going to take a look at an important moment in American judicial history. We're going to go back to 1992, and it was the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision. This was the moment that, those of you who are old enough to remember this, this was the moment when we actually thought Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned. There had been some very positive decisions leading up to Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And there was the Webster decision out of Missouri, which was very encouraging. I think that was 1989. And we were ready We were ready in 1992 to see the Supreme Court finally correct itself, and it didn't happen. In fact, it was a 5-4 decision. And this is after, by the way, Ronald Reagan had put Sandra Day O'Connor on the court, Anthony Kennedy on the court, and George H.W. Bush had put David Souter on the court. Those all turned out to be what you might call pro-choice, pro-abortion votes on the Supreme Court. Byron White, Justice Rehnquist, Anthony Scalia, Clarence Thomas, all were in the minority here. But there's a funny story about this that involves Joe Biden. And so Dr. Paul Kengor has pointed this out. And I do think that it's a good story for us to be aware of. That's coming up in this hour. And I'm looking forward to, again, talking about the terrible situation we're facing in France with the terrorism and how Emmanuel Macron is dealing, the president of France. We're also going to look at Father Michael McGivney, whose beatification will be this weekend. And he's a remarkable man, although he died at age 38. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. For Friday, October 30th, it's the Feast of St. Narcissus of Jerusalem. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. Tens of thousands of Muslims across the Middle East joined in anti-France protests today, shouting death to France in some cases. This comes after French President Emmanuel Macron defended the right of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo to publish cartoon images of Mohammed. In 2015, two Islamic extremists killed 12 people, including 8 employees of the magazine, for publishing such images. The trial in that case began last month in Paris. Philadelphia city officials are putting a curfew in place and waiting until next week to release police body camera footage of Walter Wallace Jr.'s death due to civil unrest. Mayor Jim Kenney making the announcement in a video press conference.
Releasing the body camera footage and 9/11 audio on Wednesday, November 4th, by the close of business, is in the best interest of our city and its residents.
Wallace was shot and killed Monday when two officers opened fire after protests and civil unrest erupted throughout the city. Officials saying in a news conference today they'll release the footage on November 4th. Philadelphia will have an overnight curfew starting at 9 p.m. as officials look to put an end to the unrest. Fitbit is starting a study with Northwell Health employees to see if their wearable devices can help detect COVID-19. Officials saying the research shows that our bodies start to fight the disease before more visible symptoms appear. The company is hoping to create an algorithm that would be 70% accurate in detecting COVID-19. And Wall Street is logging its worst week since March. At the closing bell, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 6.5% this week. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ dropping 5.5% over the last 5 trading days. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Let me say, before we begin our conversation with Dr. Paul Kengor, I want to thank Louise and Jeff Molnar, who have been doing an exceptional job for the last 10 years, working very hard, keeping Evangelist Radio, FM 91.3 WSJE, serving Somerville, West Virginia. This is a great time to congratulate them for their fidelity and their hard work. They've been a proud member of the EWTN Radio family, and congratulations for everything you've done there, Louise. Jeff, I know what it's like to own and operate Catholic radio stations. We do 2 of them here in Michigan ourselves. So thank you so much for your faithful work over the years. Again, WSJE, serving Somerville, West Virginia, FM 91.3. A proud member of the EWTN radio family. Well, join me right now, Dr. Paul Kengor. You know him well, author of most recently of The Devil and Karl Marx. He's professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, and senior academic fellow at the Center for Vision and Values. He's the author of over a dozen books, including A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. And Paul got my attention the other day with a story that he told about Joe Biden saving Roe v. Wade. And I thought, I remember this moment in history, so I wanted to hear Paul tell the story. How are you, Paul?
Hey, Al. Good. Good to be with you.
Yeah, likewise. Let's talk about it. Take us back to 1992.
Yeah, so it's June 29th, 1992, and it's the Amtrak station in Wilmington, Delaware. And Warren Rudman, who was the Republican senator from New Hampshire, and he was a liberal Republican, a Northeast Republican, what we in those days call like a Rockefeller Republican,
right?
Pro-choice on the abortion issue. And he looks down the platform and he sees Joe Biden, the Democratic senator from Delaware. And Rudman writes about this in his memoirs. I'm probably the only person right now listening to this who read the memoirs of Warren Rudman. but he looks down the platform and he said, yeah, at first I didn't see Joe. Then I spotted him waving at me from way down the platform. And he said Joe had agonized over his vote for David. You're thinking, David, right? He said, I knew how thrilled he must be. We started running through the crowd toward each other, and then we met, embraced, laughing and crying. And he describes how he and Biden are there. People must think they're crazy. They're hugging each other. They're jumping up and down. They're crying tears of joy. And over what, Al, right? Who's this David that they're talking about here? Well, the David was Justice David Souter.
Yep.
And he had just provided the crucial swing vote in the landmark 1992 Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey.
Right.
And as people listening to this show know, that was the decision that enshrined Roe v. Wade as the law of the land.
Right.
It quite possibly could have overturned Roe versus Wade, or at least chipped away at it. This was the one big chance since 1973.
Right.
And the majority opinion was written by, Al, of all things, three Republican appointees.
Unbelievable.
Right? Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor, both appointed by Ronald Reagan, and Justice David Souter, who had been appointed by George H.W. Bush in 1990.
Right.
And no one really knew at the time where Souter stood on Roe v. Wade, where he stood on abortion. But Warren Rudman had worked with Souter back in New Hampshire at the Attorney General's office. And he told his buddies, his pro-choice Catholic friends, Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy, on the Senate Judiciary Committee, that, it's okay, he's all right, David's one of us, I'm telling you, trust me, it's okay. So in a very stealth way, they pushed him through, and the key person here was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Joe Biden. These are the guys that blocked Robert Bork, tried to bork Clarence Thomas, right?
Yeah.
Two Reagan-Bush nominees who were definitely pro-life. And so Joe Biden shepherded through David Souter by a vote of 14-3 in the committee. And we're having this conversation when last week, not only did every Democrat in committee boycott the Amy Coney Barrett vote, they put posters in their seats to protest Amy Coney Barrett. And then when the Amy Coney Barrett floor vote went to the full Senate floor, not a single Democrat voted for her. Well, the Souter vote, thanks to Biden shepherding it through committee, was 90-9 in the Senate. And so Souter goes and he joins Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor in this horrific decision based on stare decisis, based on what Anthony Kennedy's infamous mystery clause,
right,
as it was called, where human beings, where Americans, in his definition of freedom, are free to come up with their own meanings of meaning,
right,
including their own meaning and definition of existence, of the universe, of life, as he puts it.
Yeah.
And Souter was the crucial swing vote. David Souter made it happen. And so Rudman recounts this in his memoirs, and he said that he and Biden, quote, we just kept laughing and yelling and hugging each other because sometimes there are happy endings. Sometimes there are happy endings. So they, they got their happy ending. They preserved Roe. You know, Joe saved Roe. There had been about 25 to 30 million abortions already at that point. And, you know, now here we are in 2020, and we're over 60 million abortions. And, you know, Biden's hoping, you know, to become president and save Roe again, apparently right. even packing the court if need be.
Yeah. I can remember this very well. I remember the Souter hearings. And to this day, I'm actually trying to figure out who was – I don't remember all the details. I do remember that during the hearings, David Souter told a story about a female friend of his in college that he gave encouragement to as she was seeking an abortion. And as I recall, he actually drove her to the clinic. But take that with a grain of salt, because I haven't gone back to check that out. But that's how I remembered it. And I remember saying to myself at that time, Why are we not making a stink about this guy? Because conservative voices were fairly quiet and accepting of Souter. And I don't remember, I honestly do not remember any strong pro-life opposition. And again, it might be a faulty memory, but that's back in 1990. And I just wonder, were people so confident that George H.W. Bush would make good, on his pro-life commitments? I don't know, but it just was very disturbing.
Yeah, I think so. And he wasn't vetted. And look, with Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor, I'm almost embarrassed to share this, but my friend Bill Clark knew them both really well. And yeah, I wrote Bill Clark's biography. He was like a grandfather to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sandra Day O'Connor seat in 1981 was first offered to Bill Clark by Ronald Reagan.
Wow.
And Bill Clark turned it down. And Clark told me, he said, "Yeah, it's the greatest regret I've ever had in my life." He said, "But instead, I served Reagan on his National Security Council, and we won the Cold War." I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, what can
only
you do?
So many battles you could fight.
Right.
Yeah, but I asked him. I said, "Bill, did you met with her ahead of time? Did Sandra Day O'Connor? Did you ask her about abortion?" And he kind of sighed, Al, and he embarrassed. He got kind of red in the face, and he said, "No, Paul. You know, I didn't. We talked about kids. We talked about horses. We talked about ranches." And he said, "I thought that Bill asked her," Bill meaning William French Smith,
mm-hmm.
the Attorney General. And when I asked him, he said, "Well, I thought you asked her, Bill."
Wow.
And he said, "I didn't ask her." I thought it's one of these kind of human nature moments,
right,
where people, you know, it's kind of an embarrassing thing, right, to sit down with somebody and say, "Listen, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but I really need to ask you, where do you stand on abortion?"
Yeah.
And none of them did it, Al. None of them did it.
Yeah, amazing.
So she got through. And Anthony Kennedy, now Clark knew Anthony Kennedy really well. They had lunch together once a week in Sacramento. Kennedy was on the federal bench. Clark was on the California Supreme Court. And he said, "I could tell you this one, Paul." He said, "Anthony Kennedy was pro-life." And he said, "Now he changed. He's somebody was highly influenced by his surroundings."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "And I knew that about him, that he could be that way." And he got there in Washington, and he was influenced.
Yeah.
And Clark told me, he said, "My big regret, if I would have taken the seat that went to Sandra Day O'Connor, not only would we have voted 5-4 in favor of Casey and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, but," he said, "but I think I could have got Kennedy to vote with us. I think it would have been 6-3.
Wow.
And we could have overturned it.
Can you imagine
it.
That? Wow.
Yeah, imagine.
Well,
so here we are now 30 years later almost.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about Planned Parenthood v. Casey is that though there was an agreement on the central to preserve the central holding in Roe, there's a plurality of decisions about how to do it. So it's a rather confused decision. And the basis, so it's kind of funny, while the Supreme Court has twice now said they think there ought to be a right to an abortion, they actually have forgot, they don't have, nobody knows why. They've got a number of different justifications for it. The privacy out of the Fourth Amendment, due process out of the 14th Amendment. Anyways, yeah. undue burden test, all these things. So maybe, and I stress maybe, this new Supreme Court will try to clean that up a bit and look for a case.
Right. And the audacity of today's pro-choice senators, you know, holding this up as sacrosanct and holding it against people like Amy Coney Barrett.
Right.
I quote in this article for National Catholic Register, one legal scholar who said that, you know, this 92 decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, was the greatest judicial atrocity in American history.
Yeah.
He said it's arguably the court's most reprehensible decision ever.
Wow.
And partly that's because it's based on Roe v. Wade, which was a horrific, quote unquote, constitutional decision. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really terrible.
They still haven't gotten it right over all these years, but the central holding is still law, though, unfortunately. So, Paul, thanks so much. Wonderful talking with you.
Okay.
Dr. Paul Kengorf, we talked with him recently about his outstanding book, The Devil and Karl Marx. I want to recommend that to you. And we'll have his article, which appeared in the National Catholic Register, on Joe Biden saving Roe v. Wade in the Cresta Guest Archives, AveMariaRadio.net.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Is your teen struggling with self-criticism, poor motivation, or bad eating or sleeping habits? Does he or she tend to isolate, have bouts of anger, or struggle in their academic or social life? If you've said yes to at least a few of these statements, your teen might be dealing with clinical depression. According to Johns Hopkins University, adolescent depression rates increased by 37% in the last decade. Many parents assume that depressed mood and behavior are a normal part of a teenager's life. While every teen has some struggles with self-image or peer relationships, when those struggles become a consistent cross, it's time to seek professional help. Depression isn't something your kids will grow out of, but with appropriate help, it is something they can learn to leave behind for good. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk.
And I'm Lisa Popchuk.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
I was raised a Catholic and went to church every Sunday faithfully. I met a boy and he was non-Catholic, so I left the church to be with him. When I was away from church, I yearned to be home. What brought me back was my longing for the Eucharist. The Eucharist fills me with a spirit that you can't find anywhere else. I have a peace when I walk through the doors of the Catholic Church, like that's where I belong.
We invite you to take another look at the Catholic Church. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GETCURO.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We talked a little bit yesterday about this tragic death, three deaths, in fact, in France, in Nice, France. A beheading of an elderly woman who was there for prayer in the Notre Dame Basilica in Nice. There was a sacristan who was slaughtered, and there was another woman, a 40-year-old mother, who had been stabbed, managed to escape for a while, ran to a cafe, but eventually bled out. I guess we have somebody, however, who is now in custody, the perpetrator, proud of himself for killing an old woman. A real coward. But this is embedded, of course, in a real clash of worldviews. France, which has a strict policy of secularism, different than the United States, it's stricter, is trying to figure out what to do now with its Islamic minority. With me now to help us understand what's at stake here is Raymond Ibrahim. Raymond has joined us many times. He's a widely published author, public speaker, Middle East and Islamic specialist. His books include Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. He's also editor of the Al-Qaeda Reader and has frequently provided expert testimony for Islam-related lawsuits, testifying before Congress. And Raymond, good to have you back here. Thank you.
Hello, Al. Good to be with you again. Thanks.
This is a horrific situation. What can you tell me about the perpetrator? What do we know about him, and how is this being handled in France right now?
Well, I don't think we know much about him, external factors other than, he's a Muslim, and I think he came from Morocco apparently 3 days earlier. So he's also a migrant who was brought in. And, but on the more metaphysical side, I think I know a lot about him.
Yeah.
Because I'm acquainted with this sort of behavior,
right,
through time and space, and it manifests itself with extreme regularity in the Islamic world, where Christian minorities live. So this was just an extreme act of Islamic supremacism. And, one week before, you had another beheading, which was that teacher.
Yes, Samuel Patti.
Blasphemed against, right, because he blasphemed Muhammad, supposedly, with those cartoons and so forth. But I think it's important to make a distinction that I'm starting to see, these attacks on Christians per se. In other words, the attack on Patti, okay, there was a rationale. He showed offensive pictures of Muhammad. That's why he was specifically targeted. But why are you killing elderly women worshiping quietly in front of a Catholic church?
Very good point.
And, and I think this to me is just a reflection of the, innate Islamic animus for its ancient foe, Christendom. And this is why, it's one thing I'll attack you because you offended me and you insulted me, but Christians are just fair game, per se. And, we hear this story, the beheading, which is, of course, horrific, but because I think the West is becoming so desensitized that we only hear spectacular stories like that. But actually, underneath the surface, beneath this, the tip of this iceberg, mm-hmm, of really terrorization and attacks on Christianity, there's a lot that goes on. One report that I read, a pretty legitimate report, said that on average, in France alone, two churches get attacked daily, okay? Vandalized, graffiti, and this is what I mean. It won't reach, any mainstream media because it's considered minor, but it just shows you the hostility that's just brewing
underneath the surface. And it's not, and, you know, I think one of the reasons is it's not just Muslims or Islamists. It's also extreme leftists who target, you know, target churches and hate Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this symbiotic relationship where one covers for the other or apologizes for the other, and one lashes out. You know, there's a good saying where, you know, like that man, what he did, and the terrorists, they cut off your necks, but then there's a whole, you know, army that cuts off your tongue, figuratively, by not letting you talk and speak about what's happening in France. So I think, you know, all of that is just coming into play recently.
Do you see, I mean, I read a lecture or speech given by French President Emmanuel Macron earlier in this month, and he sounded like he was pretty forthright in laying out the threat that this kind of Islam is. Is he handling this better than, say, U.S. presidents would?
It's interesting because you're correct. He's become more forthright, more assertive. He's not beating around the bush, but he's also not, you know, taking it to where it needs to go for people to really have a clear understanding. I'll address that. But I think one of the reasons that he's doing that isn't anything intrinsic to him. It's just a reflection of how bad the situation has gotten in France, per se, because France, I believe, has the largest Muslim population in all of Europe. And I think I read somewhere there are anywhere between 4 to 8 million Muslims just in France. Yeah. So obviously the situation is getting dramatic to the point that, you know, whoever you are, even if you're an extreme leftist, you're going to have to start retaliating, at least verbally, and you know, calling it as it is to some degree, because your own people are being butchered, and a lot of them see it, and a lot of them don't like it, and a lot of them are calling it out. So I think in a way he has no choice. But at the same time, you know, the things that he comes up with, until it's recognized that the sort of things that we're seeing are actually integral to Islam,
right,
by which I mean they are not aberrations. They are just things that are doctrinally backed up and manifested themselves through time and space, throughout history, everywhere Muslims live. Unless you acknowledge that, you're just destined to be trying to force a round ball through a square hole. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It just won't work. And I think that's where he's at, and that's where a lot of leaders are at. I'll give Donald Trump, because you asked me about American president, I'll give him some credit, because he's on record saying there's something about Islam, they hate us.
Right.
If you recall, he said, in fact, there's a whole doctrine about hating non-Muslims. You know, it's called al-wala' wal-bara' in Arabic, and it's called, in English, it's love and hate, where really the Quran itself, check out 60:40, Surah 60, verse 4, and it says, Abraham is your model, and he said, I hate you, to his family, because they didn't believe in Allah, and therefore, until you believe Allah, nothing but hatred will remain. So this is a whole doctrine, and it's really there. And until people like Macron can, you know, cross that line,
right,
and really start saying that, it's just, you know, it's just all these initiatives that don't work. I mean, think of all the billions that have been spent. Think of the security that you have to have, and this, you know, censorship, so feelings aren't hurt, and all the surveillance, and, you know, their equivalent of the FBI and whatever in France, and all this, is all these resources, and you got to wonder at one point, do the French think, what are we getting out of this?
Right.
You know, we bring in, you know, 4 to 8 million Muslims, and then we have to spend all this money and live in fear, and what are we getting out of it aside from, I guess, authentic falafel down the street?
Yes.
So this is really the situation we're at right now.
Well, it's amazing to me that a number of Muslim-dominated countries around the world, you've got protests and a boycotting of French products and goods, as though France is somehow the perpetrator in this whole thing.
Well, that's how it always is. You either behave like a dhimmi, which in Islamic law is the non-Muslim who lives under Islamic rule and behaves himself and, you know, never offends his masters, which is basically how they interpret the politically correct sort of leftist, pandering to them that we see often. But if you just say something that is even remotely critical about Islam, instantly they go up in arms and you're the bad guy, you're evil, you're trying to undermine them, you're a hater. I think Al-Azhar in Egypt, you know, they're really considered the premier institution or Islamic madrasa of the Islamic world, where, of course, Pope Francis often goes and meets with his friend, mm-hmm. the Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayyib. he came out basically accusing Islamophobia. This is the problem, and that what they're doing is an attack on us, and Pakistan, also a lot of Islamic Muslim leaders are now, and of course Turkey, are attacking Macron for basically saying, you know, things that are true but really not true enough. So can you imagine, you know, what would happen if the actual unadulterated truth came out?
Right, right. Is it true that Muslim-dominated countries continue to have blasphemy, anti-blasphemy laws on the book?
Yes, they do. Some explicitly have it, and some it's implicit. Pakistan, for instance, has it on the books. It's in their constitution, and you get it. And it, I think it has two articles, and one is if you offend the Quran or any kind of Islamic scripture or Islam in general, and you know you get up to life for that. But the other one is if you offend Muhammad himself, the ultimate penalty is the death penalty. And you know we've seen this time and time again being used against. You know, people will remember Asia Bibi, but she, of course, was just the tip of the iceberg. There's still many, many Christians and Hindus and even Muslims who are rotting in jails right now just on the accusation that they somehow offended Muhammad. But other countries, it's not necessarily in the law, but it's understood, meaning that if you do it, you will suffer. If not from the mob, you will be harassed and, you know, under a different pretext, taken in custody and so forth.
Yeah, I would assume there's no reason to believe these attacks are going to diminish, right? I mean, there's no governing force here which would pull back on them. So we should just assume there's going to continue to be these kind of attacks in France.
Well, you know, there have been in France, there have been all over the West, there have been in the Islamic world, and if you look at it as a continuum from the time, you know, Islamic terror. Let's go back to just 2001.
Sure.
Even though, of course, it was older than that, but from 2001 to now, I'm only seeing it get worse. I'm not seeing it get better.
Right.
And at the same time, I'm seeing Western leaders and so forth with their really impotent initiatives and their grandiose talk and so forth. And yet the reality is it just gets worse and worse and worse. Remember this woman that recently was beheaded and the other two people, for a total of three, that were killed in that church attack. I think 3-4 years earlier was that Catholic priest who actually was conducting mass.
Yeah.
And two Muslims went in and slit his throat.
That was Jacques Hamel,
so
really, I think.
Right, exactly. So this is really getting to be really bad for France. And again, like I said, this is why Macron has to at least speak up. But like you say, you know, look, Islam has been at war with everyone who's not Islamic, especially the Christian world, since its inception. So what makes anyone think some, you know, over the night remedy is going to fix this? It's
right.
Not. It's integral, it's existential, and it's, I'm sorry, it's not going anywhere.
Raymond, thank you so much. How do people stay in touch with your work?
Many thanks, Al. Best place is just my website, RaymondIbrahim.com.
RaymondIbrahim.com. We'll have it linked at our site as well. Thanks, Raymond.
All right. Take care, Al.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
The EWTN home video highlight for October is A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing 2, The Gender Agenda.
For two centuries, the ideologues of socialism or communism have used deceptive word jugglery to rebrand themselves as liberals or progressives.
Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
No doubt we are in a time of crisis, and I refer here not to the current declared pandemic, but to the constitutional crisis we are facing as a result. Unfortunately, once government officials yell pandemic in a crowded government theater, the public safety interest has taken precedent over the Bill of Rights and the public's liberty. While the fear engendered by war or a pandemic might lead politicians to assert that patent violations of the Constitution are not what they appear to be, and that even if they were what they appear to be, in these times of danger, the public safety interest demands an exception to our most fundamental liberties, history teaches they will look back on these arguments as gravely wrong, overruled in the court of history and having no place in law under the Constitution. Indeed, the response to a pandemic or any emergency cannot be permitted to undermine our system of constitutional liberties or the system of checks and balances protecting those liberties. In the final analysis, there is no pandemic exception to the fundamental liberties guaranteed by the Constitution. Let us pray that we have more judges who understand their role as guardians of the Bill of Rights and who will not wait for history to conclude that these draconian restrictions imposed on our fundamental freedoms during this current pandemic have no place in law under the Constitution. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for joining me. Some of you may have, your ears may have perked up during the news segment, and of course we take a look at the saint of the day. Today, you may have heard Saint Narcissus, and I think for most of us when we think of Narcissus, we think of Greek mythology, or we think of modern psychology with narcissism. So I thought, let me make sure we got this right. Is there a Saint Narcissus? So I went and I checked Matthew Bunsen's Encyclopedia of Saints that he published years ago. It's about 1,000 pages, by the way. It's a great book if you can get it. And not only is there a Saint Narcissus whose feast day is today, he was a bishop of Jerusalem, but there are two other ones. Yeah, there's a 3rd century Roman martyr, Narcissus, who was killed along with Crescentio. And then, again, another 4th century Narcissus who martyred with Felix, a deacon, Narcissus the bishop, Felix the deacon. Anyways, so to my great surprise, there's not only a Saint Narcissus, but there's three of them. All right, talking about saints, by the way, let's talk about a saintly man who's going to be beatified tomorrow, and that's Father Michael McGivney, famed for his founding of the Knights of Columbus. By the way, the beatification ceremony will be presented on EW10 tomorrow. I think it's 10 in the morning. More information, of course, at the website, EWTN.com. But it's my great pleasure right now to welcome to the program Maureen Walther, co-author of The Knights of Columbus, an Illustrated History, an outstanding book, by the way. She received her undergraduate degree in comparative literature at Princeton with a minor in medieval studies and served for 10 years as special assistant to the CEO of the Knights of Columbus, working on research, writing, publishing projects. And Maureen, it's great to make your acquaintance. Thank you.
It's good to talk to you.
Do you live in New Haven?
Just outside of New Haven. I grew up in Connecticut, and St. Mary's was my parish church pretty much my whole life.
So. Yeah. So we're in. I grew up in New Haven, so I'm just curious. Where are you living now? Yeah.
Yeah, Guilford.
Oh, sure. That's the great guitarist Roy Buchanan performed his last concert there at Guilford Fair back in 1987, I think, which has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about today. I just love him as a guitarist, that's all.
And except that memorable things can happen anywhere.
That's right, exactly.
Connecticut.
So let's talk about Father Michael McGivney. He lived to be only 38 years old here on Earth. That's young to accomplish what he accomplished. He must have been a remarkable young man.
Yes, he was. So he did die young. Of course, at the time, it wasn't as uncommon, especially for priests. The Hartford Diocese at the time actually had a very high turnover of priests due to premature death. Incredible. It was a dangerous profession at the time for anyone, a young man, to go into.
Yeah.
But he was very holy. And reading the records and the accounts of the time and of the people who knew him and recalled him, everyone praises the dead. McGivney was different. They praised him while he was alive, calling him a saint, and his saintly ministry to people across the board. You talk to or you read the accounts of people who knew him in seminary or at the parish or through the Knights of Columbus, and you see the same traits coming up. Now this is across decades, and you mentioned his zeal, his energy, almost like this restless energy. You just constantly doing things, and which was good. He needed it to found the Knights of Columbus. His piety, they compared his piety to the Curé of Ars.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also his sense of humor, which you don't often find in saintly biographies, but it's humanizes him.
Yeah. Now, was he kind of picked for the priesthood by his parents early on, or was this something he came to a decision about later?
No, it was early on in his life. And in fact, when he was still a teenager, he entered the minor seminary.
Okay.
So he had graduated school actually 3 years early at the age of about 12. And at that time, you're an Irish immigrant. What do? If you're 3 years ahead in your education, you go work in the factory. So he worked in a factory for a number of years, and before entering minor seminary in Montreal.
Okay.
Which surprises me.
Why Montreal?
Yeah.
Do you know? It's.
It's interesting. At the time, some of the bishops wanted their priests to have training with French Canadian Catholics, and so some of them were sending priests up to Canada for seminary, expecting them to then minister to kind of French Canadians across the border in the United States. Of course, he ended up back with Irish immigrants in New Haven. So he bounced around four different seminaries, which really I think gave him an incredibly unique formation. In terms of an international outlook, and also training with different orders, dioceses, the Jesuits, so a very, very unique training.
What year did he found the Knights of Columbus?
1882.
Okay.
So he and the men of New Haven were kind of talking about it in 1881, but really 1882.
Did he have access to men of competence and power?
Yeah. So a lot of the men that he founded the Knights with, they were almost all to man. Either Irish immigrants or kind of first generation. But a lot of them really were kind of the leading men, the leading Catholic men of New Haven.
Yes.
In terms of one of them ended up becoming the first Catholic mayor of New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
You had the constable. You had one was the fire commissioner. A number of other ones were involved in local politics. And so you get this sense that that the men he created it with were themselves very active men.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the biographies notes that he got along with essentially the go-getters.
Yeah. Okay.
These were men who, even in an anti-Catholic context, were trying to make change and were able to, in many cases, win the election of, you know, win the goodwill and elections as Catholics.
You know, I think many people don't realize that anti-Catholicism was really quite thick. Even though there were many Catholics in Connecticut and Massachusetts and Rhode Island, there was still a lot of anti-Catholicism. I came across a strange fact that Catholic doctors were not able to didn't have privileges at the large hospital in New Haven, and they ended up having to create their own Catholic hospital. That is hard for me to believe,
yes.
But I guess that's true.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, the Catholics ended up founding St. Raphael's Hospital,
yeah.
Which is where the Knights of Columbus ended up working to create the a cancer unit named after McGivney.
Did he? What was his intention? What was he actually trying to do? What was his primary objective in creating the Knights?
It was primarily to bring together the Catholic men in a way that would. I'm trying to think how to put it. There were two things going on. He was creating a fraternal society.
Okay.
That's a given. And along with that would come fraternal benefits, you know, financial support,
mm-hmm.
Kind of a passing the hat system in case one of the members died.
Mm-hmm.
So his family could stay together and wouldn't have to be split up between orphanages or things at the time. And this was a very real problem in the early 1880s. I believe he was the head of Yale Law School at the time, did a report in like 81 or 82, and he describes the conditions of the almshouse, where people who, you know, didn't have the financial means to take care of themselves would be forced to go and, you know, engage in certain kinds of labor. And he blatantly said that widows and orphans, this was their only option.
Wow.
So this is like 1881, 1882.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a real concern for all men, and especially Catholic men. Now back then, it was a problem for Catholic men because there weren't many fraternal benefit options. So you would have to be, you know, if you wanted to do something about it, you'd have to join one of these other societies.
Like Masons or something?
Yeah, there were a number of them at the time, which ranged from kind of just simply non-Catholic to, at the other extreme, anti-Catholic,
right.
or engaging in different kind of like religious or pseudo-religious rites.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the main impetuses was also to push back against the anti-Catholic narrative about Catholics as citizens.
Okay.
And by forming a body of really morally great men who felt strong in their friendship with each other, they, you know, under the banner of Columbus, who literally at the time was like the only Catholic who was revered, they could make the case that Catholics could be great Catholics and great citizens.
Interesting. Yeah, that was still a case that had to be made, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like it started to be made with the Civil War. You started having some, you know, Catholic troops in that. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand the anti-Catholicism at the time was profound in recent memory, not just in the United States, but also for these Irish immigrants. You know, they're coming from England, where, yes, there's a lot of Catholics, but there's also a lot of pressure from the Protestant powers at large there.
So we've got about 60 seconds left. Tell me a little bit about his passing. How did he die?
So he died in the second parish. Interestingly now, he died in the middle of the pandemic then.
Wow.
Of complications from that. He contracted it earlier in the year and just kind of never shook it.
What year was
but
that?
Even on 1890.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, and even while he was sick, he was still asking after other people in the parish. So his priestly mind was still looking out for other people.
Yeah. Well, this is fantastic. I'd love to talk at greater length with you in the future about the Knights. And again, spend a little more time in your book, The Knights of Columbus in Illustrated History. I hope we can do that.
Oh, absolutely. Love to.
Great. Maureen, we'll talk again. Thank you. The book is called The Knights of Columbus in Illustrated History. It is gorgeous.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
What are some major offenses against the Eighth Commandment? The Catholic Catechism states that false witness, that is, lying in court, and perjury, which is lying under oath, are especially grave sins because they are stated publicly. Such false statements contribute to the condemnation of the innocent and the exoneration of the guilty or the increased sentence of the accused. If we assume the moral fault of another without sufficient evidence, we commit the sin of rash judgment. We offend by the sin of detraction when we reveal the faults of another without an objectively valid reason to someone who did not know them. Calumny is the sin of lying about another person, thereby harming their reputation and contributing to occasions of false judgments regarding them. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being here and reminding you again that everything we discussed on the program, all the books, available in the online bookstore at AveMariaRadio.net. This beautiful Knights of Columbus Illustrated History by Maureen and Andrew Walther. I recommend it to you. There's also a book, Parish Priest, Father Michael McGivney in American Catholicism by Douglas Brinkley. He's a well-established historian, largely a presidential historian. He comes with a recommendation by Dr. Jay Dolan, Professor Emeritus of History at Notre Dame. That's another one that we'll have available for you in the online bookstore. As I go off the air, we've got Jimmy Akin coming up on Catholic Answers Live, taking your Bible questions, and Jimmy is very good in this area. Excellent, in fact. And I want to remind you that you can follow up on our every one of our program topics by going to AveMariaRadio.net and go to the Cresta Guest Archive, where you'll be able to get articles that we used in preparation for the interviews and follow-up material. Lord willing, I'll see you next Monday.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.